Yes, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here and to come talk about Lensing. There are a lot of Lensing people here. And I know that Neil has heard this talk, or some bits of it, so I hope that I can tell you why I think that there's been some renewed interest in Lensing. If I can get my computer to wake up, thank you. Renewed interest in strong Lensing, but I think that interest revolves not so much around the traditional ideas for what you would do with strong Lensing, but some new ideas, more around some new ideas that have come forth in the last couple of years. So some of the traditional ideas were to use time delays in strong lens systems to measure the Hubble constant. Well, that's turned out to be harder than anticipated because of systematic uncertainties in the lens models. It's hard to measure the time delays, but we've finally gotten past that point, and so people are doing the hard work to measure time delays. I think there are now about 9 lenses where time delays have been measured. So the issue now is the models, and there are systematic uncertainties in the angular structure of the potential and the radial profile of the potential that lead to some pretty strong systematic uncertainties in the Hubble constant. They're not insurmountable, but they're difficult. Another idea was to use strong lens statistics to try to measure the volume of the universe and to then constrain the cosmological constant, lambda. This was a mini industry built around, or that my advisor, former advisor Chris Kachanek, built in the mid-90s doing this. But I've become skeptical of that recently because I think that the possible degeneracy between cosmology and evolution in the galaxy population hasn't been adequately taken into account. So there were the standard Kachanek results putting up the limits on lambda, sort of 0.66 at 95% confidence at sort of that level. I'm not sure how to take those results right now, and I think that maybe they're going to be relaxed, so maybe Lensing is not going to be inconsistent with the lambda equals 0.7 cosmology that seems to be popular now. One area that has worked out very well. All the analyses assumed no evolution in the galaxy population, in the number density of early type galaxies. So, I think there's still some. I think that there's not a lot of evolution in early type galaxies, but I'm not sure that it's strictly zero. And I think that so people in the past assumed that there was strictly no evolution in out to redshift 1, say. And I think if you relax that assumption and conceptually try to imagine calibrating your models with, say, number counts of galaxies that are redshift of 0.5, then you actually lose a lot of the standard power to measure lambda. Now there are may still be problems with interpreting galaxy counts at a redshift of 0.5, but I think that the constraints on lambda that were placed before depended on the assumption of strict no evolution. Yeah.
Can I go back to that first point you said?
Okay.
That, the Hubble constant is hard and there's all these systematic uncertainties, but with enough work, you could.
Oh,
what do you mean?
With enough work, first of all, it's hard to measure them because you have to monitor the quasars for every couple days for a couple months, and even then you may not, the quasar may not cooperate and reveal the time delay. But Paul Schechter and Ingrid Baroud and others have spent a lot of time doing that, and they're now, I believe, about 9 measured, and there's a program to monitor some lenses with Magellan this year to try to measure more. But even once you have the time delays, then in order to get the Hubble constant, you have to interpret the time delays in the context of a lens model. You have to use a lens model basically to help you set the physical scale. And there are degeneracies. The main degeneracy that matters for the Hubble constant is the radial profile of the lens galaxy. I don't think you can break that degeneracy with lensing alone in many cases. Yes, so in fact, Leon Koopmans and Tomas Atreyu at Caltech are working on doing that. And so if you start to add that information, I'm working on a project down here to look at the environments of galaxies, of lens galaxies, working on that with Ann Zabludoff at Arizona. That will provide more information. I think if you bring non-lensing information to bear on the problem, then you may be able to break the degeneracy.
The environment
doesn't tell you directly about the profile, but it tells you about the ellipticity, or it tells you about the shear, helps you break any degeneracy involving the ellipticity of the lens galaxy. involving the angular structure of the potential. And it turns out that the shear that you require, so the connection between the shear required in the lens model and the environment of the galaxy, say the velocity dispersion of a group, if it lies in a group, that the profile enters there sort of indirectly. And I think that there may be, I don't have a slide to show that, but I think that there may be a way. Basically, if the galaxy is very concentrated, you need a larger shear to produce the same lens, versus a galaxy that's more diffuse, a smaller shear. So you can actually measure the group mass or try to constrain the group mass. You may measure the shear. And by then looking at the shear required to fit the lens, you may be able to break the degeneracy in that way. So there are a couple of different possibilities for doing this, but at this point, there are a lot of systematic uncertainties, and it remains to be seen just how well they can all be broken with these other analyses.
So it's not a matter of getting more lenses, but
More is always better, of course, and if there are any problems, if there's anything peculiar about any particular lens, for example, if you have more lenses, you can try to select ones maybe that where the environment is less important. And if you worry about environmental effects, you can select ones that aren't in clusters. And if there are any peculiarities about any particular lens galaxy, maybe by looking at the ensemble, you can sort of get a sense of the average, even if you don't understand the details of any particular one. Also, the systematic uncertainties, especially in the profile, are particularly bad for four-image lenses, because the images all lie at a common radius. But if you've got a two-image lens where the images lie at different radii, then you can get a constraint on the profile from the images there. So one hope is that if you can get some two-image lenses and sort of measure the profile with them, and some four-image lenses and you measure the angular structure better with them, then if you're willing to make the assumption that there ought to be something similar between two-image lenses and four-image lenses, provided they're all produced by early-type galaxies, then you might be able to use one set of lenses to measure some part of the potential and another set to measure some other part. And maybe you can bring them all together in an ensemble sense. So some of the other ideas people have been working on more recently are to study quasar host galaxies. It turns out that if you point NCMOS at strong lenses, you very often see arcs or even Einstein rings due to the host galaxy. So I think that this may turn out to be one of the best ways to study host galaxies beyond a redshift of 2 or 3 all the way out to redshift 5 or so, because lensing stretches the host away from the quasar and dramatically improves the contrast or reduces the contrast problem. I mentioned briefly looking at the environments of lens galaxies to try to find groups, and then use this as a sample of groups out to redshift 1 to study galaxy evolution. And then the thing that I wanted to talk about more today was this issue of using the flux ratios in strong lenses to look for substructure in the lens galaxy halos and see what we might learn about dark matter from that type of measurement. So what I wanted to talk about today was two problems related to small-scale structure. So the first problem from the lensing standpoint is a prediction that there ought to be an additional image very near the center of every lens galaxy that hasn't been seen, even in cases where we think it ought to have been detectable. So I'll argue that this is a probe of the density inside certainly subkiloparsec regimes and down to a couple hundred parsecs or perhaps even smaller. So this is not specifically cosmology related, I think, in the context of the cosmology program that's going on here, but I do think it's interesting, and it may or may not tell us something about the mass properties, and there's certainly potentially problems with CDM on such small scales. Whether or not we can actually probe CDM with this type of problem, I'll talk about. The other issue is anomalous flux ratios, namely that the flux ratios, especially in observed four-image lenses, are notoriously hard to fit with lens models. The current thinking is that this may be due to small mass clumps in the lens galaxies. And if so, it appears that there would be a quite substantial population of such clumps in order to explain the observed flux ratios. And this may provide a resolution to the satellite crisis in CDM. The crisis is that CDM seems to predict a lot of small-scale structure, a lot of subhalos that don't seem to be observed. But lensing seems to be suggesting that maybe those subclumps really are there. They may be dark, but they really are present. So I probably don't have to review too much the situation for lensing here. We're observing some distant source, a quasar at redshift 1 to 5 or so, might be a radio source. For my purposes, I don't care too much what the source is. I'm just using it as a flashlight. We have the lens galaxy in the foreground, typically an elliptical galaxy at redshift, usually from about 0.2 out to 1. And of course, the situation is that as the light travels across the universe, if it happens to pass near the foreground mass concentration, it'll be bent. So you might have the light ray coming along a trajectory like this. And the situation for strong lensing is where the impact parameter is small enough that the light can actually come around the other side of the galaxy as well and come towards us. So when we look out, we see what appears to be identical light coming from two different lines of sight. We see two images. And this is an interesting astrophysical tool because the deflection here, the lensing effect, is sensitive to all the mass, whether it's luminous or dark, whether it's smooth or lumpy, whether it's concentrated or extended, diffuse. To give you a sense of what these look like, here's some pictures from the CASLS project, the CFA Arizona Space Telescope Lens Survey. So the goal of this project is to get uniform HST imaging of all the known strong lenses. There are now about 70 cases of strong lensing by galaxies or arc-second scale strong lens systems. And so the goal is to get HST imaging to have high precision, high resolution data for all these systems to really use them as astrophysical tools. So the picture on the left is the original lens 0957 plus 561 discovered in 1979. So here's the lens galaxy and elliptical at redshift 0.36. Behind it is a quasar at redshift 1.4 that gets lensed into these two images that are separated by a little more than 6 arc seconds. So this is a pretty typical example of a two-image lens. It's a little, the separation is larger than usual because this is actually a brightest cluster galaxy in a small cluster. The additional mass actually boosts the separation. So here are the two images. Typically, if you see the two images, you look somewhere in between and you see the lens galaxy. If you have this source directly lined up directly behind the lens galaxy, then by symmetry you can get an Einstein ring. So here's the lens galaxy, and here's an infrared NICMOS image of the host galaxy of a distant radio source lensed into this nice Einstein ring. So those are typical examples of two-image lenses and rings. The other type of lens you can get is a four-image lens. To get a four-image lens, you again have a small impact parameter, close alignment between the source and the lens. But if the lens galaxy is elongated, you no longer have the symmetry required to get an Einstein ring, but you still generically get more than two images, and in fact, four is generic. So there are three basic configurations of four-image lenses. What I call a fold configuration has a pair of images close together, and then the two other images sort of form a triangle enclosing the lens galaxy. In a cusp configuration, you have three images close together on one side of the galaxy and the fourth image off by itself. I'll explain these terms fold and cusp later on. And then finally, in a cross configuration, the four images are just distributed relatively symmetrically about the lens galaxy. So those are pretty typical optical images. You see or optical images of the lenses. You see the lensed images, you see the lens galaxy. In fact, there's very little evidence for dark lenses, at least in arc-second scale lenses. Pretty much if you have an observed lens and you point HST at it, you see the lens galaxy. You can also look in the radio at some of the lenses. These are some lenses from the Cosmic Lens All Sky Surveyor class that was recently completed. Here's a typical two-image lens, here's a four-image lens and a fold configuration, and here's a 10-image lens, which Joanne knows well. This lens is complicated not because the deflector is at all complicated, it's just a simple elliptical galaxy, but the source behind it is complicated. It's actually three different sources. There's a quasar core and two jets. The core is quadruply imaged, one of the jets is quadruply imaged, and the other jet is doubly imaged. So I mentioned Joanne because she actually has done quite detailed modeling of this system to understand that morphology and also to understand what it implies about the lens galaxy. But what happens in general and with the radio lenses is you see an even number of images, 2, 4, 10. You don't see any evidence of the lens galaxy at the center of the potential for the most part. Most of these ellipticals or lens galaxies are radio quiet. But nor do you see any evidence for any additional images. Well, that's interesting because lens theory would tell us that there ought to be one more image. There's a mathematical theorem first proved in 1981 and since proved with a variety of mathematical techniques called the odd image theorem, which says that if your mass distribution has a density cusp that's shallower than r to the minus 2, so certainly if you have a flat core, but even if you have a cusp that's shallower than r to the minus 2, then you should always have an odd number of images. What you would expect to see then is two or four observed images, And one image that's it's been called the third image or the fifth image or sometimes the odd image, or I just call them core images because they ought to appear near the core of the lens galaxy. In the optical, I mentioned that that you almost always see the lens galaxy sitting at the center of the lens potential, so you might not expect to see this additional image. But in the radio, the lens galaxy is usually radio quiet, so you ought to be able to see this thing. The class radio maps typically have a dynamic range of a few hundred up to a few thousand in a couple of cases, and they haven't seen any evidence for these images yet. I'll actually, it should be very close to the center of the lens potential. I'll address that, I think, two slides from now. But there are, lens theory does give you a bound on the position where this image should appear. It's a small region. It's not strictly at the center of the potential, but it's a small region near the center. So the question is simply, where are the core images, especially in the radio? The qualitative answer that people have talked about for 15 years now is that these images can be demagnified by the highest central density of the galaxy. And this is purely a gravitational effect. I'm not talking about extinction or scatter broadening or any electromagnetic effects. Just gravitationally, the image can be demagnified. The question is, do the numbers work out? And this has been a long-standing puzzle, again, dating back more than 15 years now, trying to figure out, okay, if you make sort of certain assumptions about the core radii of the lens galaxies or the density cusp, do we really expect that we should have seen any core images by now? Is the fact that we haven't seen any core images a surprise or not? And I came back to this problem because I think that the models that people had done before were too simplified, and I'll explain that more in a minute. And also there are more data now. I came at this problem from the lensing standpoint, the question, where are the core images? I think it does have a lot of interesting connections. There are a lot of people who are interested in studying the centers of galaxies, especially the centers of elliptical galaxies. Todd Lauer, Sandy Faber, and others have spent a lot of time measuring the profiles of elliptical galaxies with HST because the centers are interesting for dynamical reasons. They have short dynamical time scales, so there are various processes that are interesting there. They maybe say something about galaxy formation, maybe collect remnants of the galaxy formation process as the center of the potential well. If you have a dwarf galaxy that falls in, maybe the core remains intact and actually falls into the core of the galaxy and you get a kinematically distinct core. Maybe the centers will give us clues to the interactions, any interactions that there may be between baryons and dark matter. There's also the potential problem that CDM is facing about the concentration problem, that CDM seems to overpredict the densities of dark matter on kiloparsec scales. There's some controversy over this still. There's a variety of pieces of evidence suggesting that there might be a problem. But I came at this because when I had looked at this set of models, I had said that there seemed to be something funny going on. The densities, the predicted densities maybe were not high enough to suppress core images at the required level. So I wanted to look at the models more carefully. Yeah.
It's not just CDM at these scales, right? So
right. So the issue is
probably, I'm interested in what happens in there, but I'm not sure I'm testing.
Right. So in fact, the thing that happened here was the CDM is certainly not the only thing going on. The stars are very important. In fact, I'll argue the rest of this, that the stars are the most important thing. And in fact, when I did this before, the models that I used to represent the stellar distributions were inadequate on 100 parsec scales. So in fact, that sort of motivation why I was interested, part of the reason I was interested in it, but the answer is that the models for the stellar distributions I had made before were not appropriate on these scales.
The same comment applies to the strong lens statistics.
The strong lens statistics are not so bad because the strong lens statistics are dominated by what's happening on sort of 5 kiloparsec scales, where the models I was using, I was using Hernquist models for the stellar distribution, which are probably better, which are probably reasonable at 2 effective radii, but not reasonable at 100 parsecs.
Well, but also the question, is there a thematic attraction? What is the CM mass of vibration, stellar mass of vibration?
Right. So yes, you can certainly quibble about all the details in here. And I looked at mass to light ratios and on adiabatic contraction and all that in this analysis. I didn't want to go into that in detail here. But the consensus or the conclusion that I drew from this study was if you consider adiabatic contraction, if you worry about reasonable mass to light ratios and so forth, then it seems that the densities are too high to the CDM densities are too high to agree with with observed lens statistics. But that conclusion is perhaps not as strong as that coming out of rotation curves or bars or anything else. There are a lot of assumptions that go into any of these analyses, which is why there's controversy. But the last thing was, last year, Shude Mao pointed out that these core images are sensitive to central supermassive black holes that may appear in the lens galaxy. So I wanted to see, can we turn the problem around and maybe use these images to actually constrain the supermassive black holes, potentially reaching out to a redshift of 1 with these systems. So to answer your question about the locations of these images, lens theory tells us that there are generically two critical curves, two curves where the lensing magnification is formally infinite, and you have high amplification and large distortions. So the outer curve is the Einstein ring, also sometimes called the tangential critical curve, because an image that lies near this curve would be highly amplified and tangentially distorted. This is the cause of and the location of the giant tangential arcs in cluster lenses. But there's a second critical curve at smaller radii called the radial critical curve, because an image near this curve would be distorted radially. In fact, this is how you get radial arcs in clusters. And lens theory tells us that these curves bound the locations of the images. In a two-image lens, you'd always have one image outside the Einstein ring, one image between, and this core image would always be found within this radial critical curve. Likewise, in a four-image lens, you'd have two images outside, two images between, and again, one image inside this curve. So the core images are always bounded, always contained by within this curve. So this radial critical radius sets the characteristic scale for the core images. And qualitatively, if you increase the central surface density, the central density of the lens galaxy, you make this curve smaller and you make the core images fainter. That's about all you can say in a model-independent sense. To look at the question quantitatively, I do have to make a specific set of models. So I use what's called the Nuclear Law models, which were introduced by Todd Lauer and Sandy Faber and others when studying the surface brightness profiles of early-type galaxies. They found that a double power law generically works well. You have the surface brightness going as some power law r to the minus beta at large radii, a different power law r to the minus gamma at small radii, and then there's some parameter called alpha that specifies the sharpness of the break. So I could just start looking at the core images as a function of all these parameters, but to make sure I sample the parameters realistically, I actually take 73 nearby ellipticals from the literature where people have actually resolved and measured these profiles, and use them to construct mock lens galaxies, place those galaxies at a redshift of a half, and study them. So these are the sources of the 73 galaxies. In the past, in analyses of the core images, people always assumed either that the core was strictly flat, or that there was a single power law that was applicable at all radii. So I think that this is an important generalization, and it's nice because I can take the parameters directly from the literature, so it is, I think, a realistic set of models. When I take those 73 galaxies, I study the core image properties, and two of them actually don't produce core images at all. I said that the odd image theorem holds only if the central density cusp is shallower than r to the minus 2. There are two galaxies where the profile is actually steeper than that, at least on the scales that have been observed. So they don't produce any core images. For the other 71, it'd be nice to characterize the core image properties for any given galaxy with just a single number. So I actually compute the magnification of the core image and then just average over source positions. So I compute the mean mu for the 71 galaxies, and then here I just plotted a distribution of actually log mu. What really surprised me when I looked at this was that this distribution spans more than 4 orders of magnitude. There are some galaxies that predict relatively bright core images, demagnified by a factor of 2 or 3 or 5 or so. But many others predict core images demagnified by a factor of 100, 1,000, 10,000, and more. I think the diversity here simply represents the fact that there's a large diversity in the central properties of observed early-type galaxies. So that suggests that there ought to be some bright core images. The question is, how common are they? They're probably not going to be all that common, but again, do the numbers work out? So to try to understand that spread, one thing is to try to understand the scale being probed by these images. Again, this radial critical radius sets the physical scale. Here I've plotted a histogram of the radial critical radius for the Mach lens galaxies in parsecs and in units of the nuclear break radius. So the median of the distribution here is about 200 parsecs. It sometimes gets as large as a couple of kiloparsecs. Sometimes we're down at a few tens of parsecs. So that's the origin of the statement that we're probing a sub-kiloparsec regime, and often even a few hundred parsecs or smaller. So we've got these four orders of magnitude spread in the magnification. To try to understand that, I looked at how log mu varies with the different parameters. So I just made scatter plots of log mu on the vertical axis versus various parameters in the models. The outer slope of the nuclear profile, the inner slope, the mass, or this is actually the velocity dispersion. And three parameters or combinations of parameters that sort of represent the concentration of the mass distribution. And the thing here is these are scatter plots. I don't see any clear trends. There's sort of some trends with the concentration. As you increase the concentration, you tend to decrease the magnification. But they're not strong trends, and they're certainly not tight. So there doesn't seem to be any simple property of, you know, any single parameter of the mass distribution that really tells you what is going on with the core images. What's happening is that this radial critical radius that sets the scale is very often near the break in the nuclear profile. So you're not in one power law regime or the other. It sort of depends on all the different parameters in a complicated way. So we can now just ask the question, should we see any core images? Specifically, which of the model galaxies have relatively bright core images, say a magnification greater than a tenth? There are three such galaxies in the sample, but two of them are dwarf galaxies. Dwarfs have small lensing cross sections. They're poor lenses. They're not likely to turn up in real lens samples very often. The other is interesting, NGC 6166. It's the brightest cluster galaxy. It happens to be the most distant and least concentrated galaxy in the sample observed by Sandy Faber. In fact, they observed it because they could. If it were any more concentrated, given its distance, they couldn't have measured its profile. So this galaxy is atypical. So I think that these types of galaxies are not going to be common in real lens samples. But to be more quantitative, I can actually compare to the data. I take the results from the class survey. They haven't found any core images yet, so they've only got upper limits. And here I've plotted the distribution of their upper limits. I believe these were 3 sigma upper limits from 15 lenses. And then I plot the distribution of the core image magnification that I would predict from my models, and it's well below the observed upper limits. So the models don't predict core images any brighter than observed. In fact, you'd have to take this curve and shift it to the left by about an order of magnitude to make the curves overlap. So we're about a factor of 10 in sensitivity away from finding these things regularly, I think. They can go deeper. The only question is integration time. The reason that there's such a spread here in the data is because the images, some of their lenses have sources that are relatively bright, and some of their lenses have sources that are relatively faint. In the systems where you think the source is intrinsically bright, you have a better, for given depth or for given integration time, you have a better chance of seeing the core image. So that's how you get these sort of limits. And then out here would be the cases where maybe the observed images are only a little bit above the detection threshold.
The lens must be wrong. You have to subtract it off the lens.
These are all radio data. And so these are all systems where the lens is radio quiet. They do actually have a couple of systems where they see flux from the center of the potential. They think it's actually flux from the lens galaxy because it has a different radio spectral index. And so these are cases where you don't see any flux, so you can really derive strong upper limits on the central image. So I mentioned that one of my motivations was to ask the question of whether we could use these things to probe supermassive black holes after Shudo Mal had pointed out that the black holes effectively deepen the potential well and help suppress the core images. So to look at that in more detail, I took four of the galaxies.
But you're arguing that we really don't need to deepen any further.
Right. So in fact, I don't need to deepen the potential well any further to explain the current data. And the question is sort of quantitatively or even qualitatively, conceptually, what is the effect? And so here I plotted no longer just the mean magnification for each galaxy, but actually the full distribution, the cumulative distribution. And the black holes do suppress core images, but only at the very faint end of the distribution. Here's the model without a black hole. Here's a model if you add a black hole normalized by the empirical correlation between black hole mass and galaxy velocity dispersion. So you do get a suppression, but you're only several orders of magnitude down. And we're still out here in the tail. We haven't found any of them yet. So potentially it's an interesting effect, But we're, again, we're sort of an order of magnitude away from finding these things regularly, and several orders of magnitude further from being able to use them as black probes of the black holes.
Is there a simple way to understand that?
Yes, because if you assume that the black hole lies at the center of the lens potential, then it affects only the images, or only core images that would appear around it. And if you actually look at the core image magnification as a function of radius, it is lowest in the middle, and it increases as you go out to the radial critical curve. So if you've got some distribution of core images already, you plop the black hole in, it's going to swallow or suppress only the images close by, sort of within a few Einstein radii of the black hole. And those are the very faintest core images. Another possibility is if you've got a binary black hole, then you have the potential that at least one of the black holes may sit a little bit further out. And this is something I've looked at with Shude Mao and a student of his. You may potentially suppress core images at brighter magnifications a little bit better than a single black hole. But I think that quantitatively it's not going to be all that different.
So you were saying that this is like 100 parsecs away. So if the central black hole is supposed to be in the center to within parsecs?
Well, I don't actually know the answer to that in the sense of dynamic. Pardon? Okay. But the
maybe
right, but the
bumping around the stars and
yeah,
moving around.
Stars would be affected.
Right, but the question is, if you've got the black hole sort of sloshing around in the middle of the galaxy, how far could it move from the very center of the galaxy potential? I don't actually know the answer to that question. I should find that out. For our own galaxy.
Yeah,
well, we don't know if that's the center of the galaxy.
It's
going to
depend on merging history.
Right. Right. Now, the thing is that with the binaries, the binary cases we've looked at, I think that the even reasonable binary separations are still going to be maybe comparable to the Einstein radius of the single black hole. So you're not going to see huge effects. So if you move the black hole by sort of order its Einstein radius, you're not going to change these effects very much.
At
a few parsecs, certainly not at 100 parsecs.
Right.
Right. So therefore, I mean,
right. So that's all to say, just about these, that I think the core images are a unique probe of the densities at small radii inside these distant ellipticals on physical scales that we wouldn't be able to probe otherwise. I would expect a remarkably wide range of core image properties, many, many orders of magnitude. But at this point, I'd say that the stellar densities alone are probably enough to explain the fact that we haven't seen any core images yet. Been talking to people about better ways, new ways that we might try to search for them. One is simply increase the radio sensitivity, just integrate longer. Another possibility is maybe do some narrowband optical imaging. If you could do narrowband imaging centered on a wavelength where you know the quasar has, say, a bright emission line, then maybe you could reduce the contrast problem or improve the contrast of the image relative to the lens galaxy. So maybe you could do that in the optical or something like that.
So on the better radio sensitivity, my understanding is that many of these radio images are more or less snapshots.
I think the upper limits that they've derived are deeper than that, because the class survey did a series of observations. They first did VLA snapshots, you're right about that, but then they would do follow-up with the Merlin array, and then with VLBI if possible. So I know certainly some of the systems where the dynamic range is 1,000 or 2,000, those clearly come from deep observations, and they've done targeted deep observations of at least a few. I actually need to talk to the people at Jodrell Bank and see to what extent they could feasibly just increase the integration time over what they've done and maybe go a factor of 10 deeper.
Yeah, well, the VLA, I mean, currently is being upgraded.
Right. Well, Merlin is being upgraded as well. So there's certainly a good prospect on a technical side for both of those.
Is it a lot of time?
I don't actually remember. And again, part of the reason is that at this point there's such a diversity in the observational limits. So and you'd have to target the observations as well based on the brightness of the source. So there, in a couple of cases, they've actually targeted a few of these lenses for detailed searches. But for the most part, I think they've just taken whatever they had and derived up a limit. So I don't think there's been yet a systematic search for core images and all these things by really doing targeted maps. So that's all I wanted to say about that topic. Any other questions before I go on? No. Okay. The other topic I wanted to talk about was the anomalous flux ratios and using them as potentially a probe of CDM substructure. So the context for this problem is that within CDM, dark matter halos are predicted to be lumpy. CDM, of course, leads to hierarchical galaxy formation, so small objects form first and then they aggregate into larger objects. If the dark matter is cold and collisionless, then the small objects that form first are allowed to be very dense. So as those small objects merge together into larger objects, they're not fully disrupted by tidal forces. So when you form a large object, those large halos contain the remnants of their many progenitors. So to show this, I've got pictures taken from simulations by Ben Moore et al. Here's a simulation of a cluster mass halo, 10 to the 15 solar masses. Here's a simulation, just a pure dark matter simulation of a galaxy mass halo, 10 to the 12 solar masses. If you note some similarities here, it's because they actually use the same initial conditions and just scaled them down in mass. Well, if you want to compare this to observations, well, clusters really do look like this. You'll often see a dominant central CD galaxy. You'll see small structure in the form of all the other galaxies that are orbiting in the common potential well. So that looks great. But galaxies don't look like this. People have looked long and hard for satellites of our own galaxy, and they found a few dozen. But they haven't found the few hundred that you would predict from simulations like this. So that is put forth as another potential crisis with CDM. CDM seems to overpredict the amount of substructure, at least in galaxy mass halos. So what does this mean? There are two different types of resolutions people have talked about. One lies in the realm of particle physics. Maybe the dark matter really isn't cold and collisionless. Maybe instead it's warm or self-interacting, fuzzy, sticky. Pick your favorite adjective. Somebody's probably written a paper about dark matter of that form. So maybe this assumption of cold and collisionless dark matter that leads to high densities in the small objects, maybe that's just wrong. Or maybe this solution lies in the realm of astrophysics. Other people have pointed out that we can only see these clumps if they contain stars or gas. So maybe there are astrophysical processes that suppress star formation, say, in small mass clumps, make star formation very inefficient. Maybe the galaxies really do contain a lot of mass clumps, but most of them are invisible. So these are obviously very different possibilities. It's a question of whether we need to solve the problem to resolve this crisis within the astrophysics community, or whether we need to go talk to the particle physicists and say, give us more alternate types of dark matter. To distinguish between those possibilities, we need to either find or rule out this putative population of dark objects, of objects detectable only by their mass. So the phrase only by their mass brings lensing to mind. You might ask the question, what effects would such a population have on strong lenses? Well, there are two main observables, the image positions and the image brightnesses. The positions are determined by first derivatives of the lensing potential, just represented by d phi here. And those are fairly insensitive to clumps. If you take a smooth potential and you drop a bunch of mass clumps into it, you're going to change the first derivatives at some level, but not by a huge amount. But with the brightnesses, they're determined by second derivatives of the potential. So that extra derivative gives you one extra power of sensitivity to small-scale structure. So these are actually very sensitive to clumps. You might then imagine looking for evidence for this clump in the form of lenses where a smooth model can reproduce the image positions, but cannot reproduce the brightnesses. In fact, that situation is very common. In the mid-90s, many people, including myself, were making models and finding that with four image lenses, we could very easily reproduce the image positions, but not the brightnesses. We didn't know what was going on or what to make of that result until Schutemau and Peter Schneider wrote a paper in 98 making this very point, that if there is small-scale structure in the lens galaxy, then it wouldn't have much effect on the positions, but it would on the brightnesses. So maybe the fact that we can't fit the brightnesses tells us that there is such a small-scale structure. Now, I'll mention that the idea of small structure in the lens galaxy producing an observable effect is not new. It goes back 20 years now to the idea of quasar microlensing. If you have a star passing in front of the quasar, you can actually get a noticeable brightness enhancement of the image. So if a star can produce a detectable effect in the images, then surely something bigger of the type of substructure predicted by CDM can. So these are various papers that have talked about this problem in the last year and a half or so. I just want to say briefly what's at stake here, what's potentially at stake. I think there's the possibility to establish a link from lensing to astrophysics to the physics of dark matter. The idea is to observe the lenses, and then in a chain of logic to try to find the systems that are inconsistent with smooth models, to use those to infer the amount of substructure required. This becomes a statistical argument. You basically add substructure until the models are statistically consistent with the data. But then you can compare this inferred amount of substructure to what's predicted with CDM. And to the extent that the CDM predictions depend on the assumption of cold and collisionless dark matter, then you might be able to test those assumptions and perhaps even constrain the physics of the dark matter particle. So I want to comment specifically on Neil's paper making a quantitative claim about this effect. So they did a Bayesian analysis of substructure. They took a sample of 7 lenses, tried to fit them with smooth models, and found that 6 of them had flux ratio anomalies. 6 of them had fluxes that could not be easily fit with the smooth models. So then they started adding substructure to the models and did a Bayesian analysis where you basically ask, how much substructure do I have to add until I can fit the observed flux ratios? So the Bayesian analysis produces an a posteriori distribution for a parameter they call FSAT. It's the satellite mass fraction. It's sort of roughly the fraction of the mass in the halo that is contained in bound subclumps. So they actually have 3 different curves here based on different assumptions about the uncertainties in the measured flux ratios. In this curve, they assume that the measured flux ratios are uncertain by 5%, 10%, or 20%. They take as their fiducial number the 10% curve, which I think is actually probably a bit conservative, but it's okay to be conservative. So what they get is a lower limit on the satellite mass fraction. You may not be able to read the units. Here's 1, here's a tenth, 1%, and 1/10%. So they say that for their fiducial case, the best fit value is about 2%, and with a 90% confidence range of 0.6 to 7%. So they say they've got a statistically significant detection of substructure. The fact that FSAT is not zero means that they've detected substructure. And the amount that they've inferred, it seems consistent with the predictions of CDM, broadly indicated by this band here. Not only that, it's inconsistent with what you would expect from normal satellite populations, from normal dwarf galaxies or globular clusters, any type of sort of known familiar types of substructure. That would actually lie off to the left of the plot here. So far it appears that the existence of these flux ratio anomalies and the quantitative analysis that Neil and Chris Kachanik did seems to be a major success for CDM. It seems to confirm the predictions, the amount of substructure on small scales, and in doing so rules out alternatives like warm or self-interacting dark matter. But I want to recall the assumptions. The need for substructure at this point is inferred from the failure of models to fit the observed fluxes. So this is not, at this point, a model-independent statement. Also, the substructures has been specifically assumed to be the granular stuff predicted by CDM, and that assumption may be subject to some debate as well. So I'd like to suggest that we need to go back and look and revisit this chain of logic taking us from observed lenses to test of CDM and conclusions about dark matter, and to try to rebuild that chain of logic link by link to try to make each link as strong as possible.
How much does it depend on where you actually put the substructure?
The substructure that matters for the most part is only the stuff that lies near the images. So you could put substructure down elsewhere and not really have much effect on the observables. So the assumption is that the substructure is distributed in some way throughout the halo of the lens galaxy, and that it's fair to assume that, say, for a four-image lens, that the four different lines of sight through the lens potential maybe are representative of lines of sight in some way.
So the FSAT value is the FSAT value at locally.
Right. In fact, they took that to be uniform for all images, for all lenses. And you can question whether that assumption is valid, because there is maybe a spatial distribution of these subclumps that you have to worry about. Their argument was that these images tend to lie near the critical curve, where the density has a particular value. So it's probably not a crazy assumption, especially for a first analysis, but that is something else to think about. What I want to emphasize, though, right now is going back to the very beginning of the chain and talk about just finding these flux ratio anomalies. This is work that I've done with Scott Gowdy at the Institute for Advanced Study and Arlie Petters at Duke. The question is that at this point, the whole subject and all the conclusions rest on identifying these systems that you think you can't fit without substructure. But you may ask the question, do the anomalies that we find, the disagreements between the data and the models, really indicate substructure? Or are they just a failure of imagination in the models? Do they indicate that we've simply been too narrow-minded about the types of models that we've used for this analysis? The sort of philosophical point here is that proving a negative is difficult. If you want to prove that there are no smooth models that are consistent with the data, and you want to do that by searching parameter space, you're going to be at it for a long time to try to convince yourself and others that there's no little corner of parameter space that you've just missed. Fortunately, though, there are some strong generic statements that can be made about certain combinations of fluxes. So we can actually turn this into a model-independent analysis using these generic statements. And the idea here, again, is to forget about the later links in the chain. Forget about what causes the substructure, what the implications for CDM are, what causes the anomalies, or what the implications for substructure and CDM are. Right now, let's just focus on finding these anomalies, finding systems that seem to be inconsistent with smooth mass models. So I said that these generic statements involve certain combinations of fluxes, and this is where the fold and the cusp configuration that I mentioned before come in. So here's the fold lens that I showed. A fold lens, I said, had two images very close together, and then the two other images sort of form a triangle enclosing the lens galaxy. If you make a model of the system, here are your four images. Here are the two critical curves that I mentioned before. Here's the tangential critical curve. Here's the radial critical curve. If you take the critical curves and map them back to the source plane, you get the caustics. The caustics are where the number of images changes. If you're outside both caustics, you only have one image. If you're between the caustics, you have two images. If you're inside the central caustic, you have four images. And the central caustic has this generic form of four cusps connected by what are called fold lines. And the reason they're called fold lines is depicted schematically here in the upper right. If you think about the lens equation mathematically, you can think about it as a mapping from the two-dimensional image plane to the two-dimensional source plane. And what the mapping does is it sort of takes the image plane and it distorts it, it stretches it, it actually folds it over on itself and then projects it down into the source plane. So the fold is sort of, again, shown schematically up here, kind of take the image plane and fold it back over on itself, such that if you're outside the fold, you only have one image, but if you're inside the fold, you pick up two additional images. And if you study the lens equation mathematically, you can show that locally, at least, this fold has a generic form, and the most important feature is that it's symmetric. So if you move your source just inside the fold, you're going to get two images just on either side of the fold line, and that's these two images here. And because the fold is symmetric, those two images ought to be mirror images of each other. They ought to have the same magnification, the same flux. So if you take the difference between the two fluxes, that ought to vanish. So that, again, depends only on the local properties of the lens mapping here, not on any global properties of the lens model. So that's why it's a generic model-independent statement. It depends only on the fact that the fold is symmetric, at least locally. The other type of relation involves the cusp configuration, which, as I mentioned before, has three images close together on one side of the galaxy, the fourth image on the other side. This is a radial lens that actually does have five components, but component E has a different radio spectral index and is thought to be, therefore, something else. It's probably flux from the lens galaxy. So this is not an example of a core image, unfortunately, I think. But here are, so if you make a model here, here are again the images, and now you see that the source lies out here in the cusp. What's happening near the cusp is, again, you have this folding, but the folding is a little different. because at the cusp point, you actually imagine fixing the folding, fixing the fold. So outside of the cusp, you don't have the lens plane actually overlapping itself, it's just distorted. Whereas inside the cusp, the lens plane still overlaps itself. So again, if you're outside, you have one image. If you're inside, you have three images. And now because you fixed this point, you've changed the nature of the fold, and you have to make a relation involving three images. And in fact, it has the generic form A minus B plus C should vanish. You can actually see automatically from this lens that this relation is violated because B is actually fainter than images A and C. So this relation can't be satisfied. And I'll come back and talk about this lens more in just a moment. So the idea is that these fold and cusp relations are abstract and strong and model-independent statements about combinations of fluxes. So conceptually, or at least in the ideal case, the only way to violate them is to introduce structure in the lens potential, variations in the density on scales smaller than the separation between the images. Now that's sort of the ideal case. In practice, that statement is limited because these ideal relations formally require a source that's asymptotically close to the fold or the cusp. They basically come from a Taylor series analysis. So you can ask the question, if the source is close but not asymptotically close, as you would expect in a real lens, how well should these relations be satisfied? How well should the relations hold in practice, and can we actually use them to identify flux ratio anomalies directly from the data? So what we've done so far is to begin with the cusp case, because mathematically it's a natural place to start. The cusp relation involves a triplet of images, so we take a four-image lens and pick some triplet of images. To quantify the image configuration, we let d be the separation between these three images, and let theta be the angle subtended by the images. So here's the lens galaxy, here are the images. Sort of conceptually, you have a triplet that's associated with the cusp if the values of theta and d are relatively small, if these three images are close together and the fourth image is off on the other side. If you pick a different triplet, say involving this other image, then you get a large value of theta and d. So this is a triplet of images that is not associated with the cusp. The cusp relation has the form that A minus B plus C should vanish, so we want to look at that quantity. To make it dimensionless, we divide by just the sum A plus B plus C, and then call that R cusp, the residual from the ideal cusp relation. The ideal cusp relation would be of the form R cusp equals 0. We want to see how well that holds for realistic lens models and for the data. To do that, to look at the realistic lens models, we do it in a Monte Carlo sense. We first of all just pick a particular lens model. We take an isothermal sphere with a shear of 10%, which is a pretty typical configuration for a four-image lens. Question?
Now then you're going to basically compare the models.
Yes. The question is whether you can make what you reasonably believe to be a reasonable family of models. And this allows you to sort of explore the entire, I'm only looking at one model parameter here. I'll do sort of the whole family of models in a moment. The idea here is to compare the data to sort of the whole parameter space at once without actually searching parameter space. You can still quibble about whether the family of models we have chosen is reasonable or not. And so that's certainly a limitation of the analysis. But you're not explicitly searching parameter space, so you sort of get to include the entire parameter space in one shot. So for right now, we have just a particular lens model. So you're right, we're only comparing the data to one particular model. But this is just a way to get started. So we take this model, throw down sources randomly behind it, and create a bunch of mock lenses. We created about 5,000 lenses in this case. And all the little black points here are the results for those mock lenses. So we identify all the triplets, we compute the opening angle theta, the separation d, and this cusp residual, R cusp. What we find is that for small values of the angle and the separation, those are cusps that are very tight. Those correspond to sources that are very close to the cusp, and indeed R cusp vanishes. As you move out, the source is moving away from the cusp, theta, the opening angle and the separation are getting larger, and R cusp is allowed to deviate from zero. But there's a firm upper envelope on the value that it can attain. There are actually two upper envelopes. This corresponds to the minor axis of the lens potential. This corresponds to the major axis of the potential. But you can actually derive this upper limit analytically, this blue curve here. And that's nice because now you can compare to real data, the large color triangles are data for real lenses, and we can say without actually trying to fit the lens that these models, because they lie above this curve, are inconsistent at least with this particular model. Again, this is only a single model, so we want to understand how this upper limit depends on various parameters. The parameters that matter are the profile of the lens potential, or of the lens galaxy, the shear from the environment, and the ellipticity of the lens galaxy. In fact, profile is not very important. Shear and ellipticity, the angular structure parameters, are most important, because they are what allow you to create density variations between images that are close together. So we think we understand the parameter dependencies. And now we can actually incorporate them into the Monte Carlo simulations by adding a distribution of ellipticity and shear, the parameters that matter most, into the Monte Carlo simulations. So no longer do we obtain strict upper envelopes on our cusp as a function of theta and d, but we do get confidence regions. So here's the 68% confidence region, here's 95%, 99%, and 99.9%. So again, as, say, at small values of the separation, triplets that are very tight, the source is very close to the cusp, and for this family of smooth models, our cusp should always be very close to zero. As you move out in separation, our cusp is allowed to deviate from zero, but you still get upper limits. Again, not firm upper limits, but these are now confidence limits. So we can now take the data and toss them onto the plot. There are 17 published four-image lenses. Only four of those are cusp lenses. In fact, they're the four down here with relatively small values of theta. We can actually do the analysis for all 17 lenses, but we expect that this cusp relation analysis really should be interesting only for the four cusp lenses. Of those four, two are clear outliers. This is the lens that I mentioned before, B2045. This is another lens, RxJ0911. So you can see that 2045 lies well above the confidence region. You might quibble about the distribution of ellipticities and shears that we've assumed in this analysis, but there's basically no way to modify those distributions to make make a value of R-cusp as large as observed in 2045. The case is maybe a little less clear-cut for 0911 because it's not quite so far from the upper limits. But we've looked at that carefully in terms of the observational uncertainties and what assumptions about the ellipticity and shear mean for these upper limits. And we still believe that this lens is anomalous at better than 99%. Yeah. Right. The reason is that, which actually goes to the point that I was going to say here, what we've tried to do in this case is find what is the maximum possible value of R-cusp that you might reasonably expect for a given opening angle or a given separation. We haven't asked whether the model that produces that value of R-cusp is at all consistent with the positions of the images. So we've thrown away a lot of information and are using basically one piece of information here, one piece of information here. All these two panels tell you is that the separation is a little bit more powerful in revealing anomalies. But we've actually done the analysis also taking into account both the separation and the angle, and that even gives you a little bit more power in finding anomalies. So the idea here was just to sort of look at what's the most basic way you might quantify the image separation or the image configuration, and to throw away any other information, because almost any other information would require explicit modeling. And we've wanted to avoid that and to be as conservative as possible, say what's the largest possible value of R-cusp that we might reasonably expect at any given value of the separation. So in fact, this analysis does not identify the lens 1422, which is said to be anomalous from detailed modeling. I've done that. That's the lens that Shudeh Mao and Peter Schneider originally used in their analysis. A lot of other people have looked at it, and I believe it's the green point right here. So it's not really, it's not flagged by our analysis because, again, we're trying to be as conservative as possible. So we do think that there are observed flux ratios that cannot be fit by smooth models. And again, I do have to throw the word reasonable in here because you can quibble about the family of models we've used. And all we can really say is that for models using ellipticity and shear with some reasonable distribution of ellipticity and shear, we sort of search the parameter space all at once, but there might be other families of models. We think that ellipticity and shear incorporate almost all the interesting effects that you might want to throw into a smooth model. But that's why we still have to say that, to throw the qualifying word reasonable in here. So we can find some of these anomalies using these abstract relations, but we don't find all of them. More sophisticated and therefore less robust analyses are going to be required for some cases. But still, I think that means that the first link in the chain from lenses to tests of CDM using substructure can be made quite strong. Just to review that, the first step is to find the lenses with flux ratio anomalies or with flux ratios that cannot be fit by smooth models. So I've tried to convince you that I think we can do that rigorously and robustly. The next step is to infer the amount of substructure. And there are a lot of interesting questions to ask here. We need to understand very carefully, what do the anomalies really imply about galaxy mass distributions? And there are sort of a variety of sub-questions. What do we mean by substructure, first of all? If we're talking about fitting lenses with mass distributions that are not smooth, well, must the departure from smoothness be the granular CDM clumps, or could it be other stuff? Could it be stars, dwarf satellites, tidal streams, dark matter caustics, other types of objects? For that matter, could the anomalies simply be caused by electromagnetic, not gravitational effects? I think the answer to this question is no, based on currently we have some multicolor data for some of the lenses. You can actually look at whether there is any evidence for any differential extinction in the images. And the answer is that if there is any, it's small, and you can correct for it with multicolor data. Another possibility is scatter broadening by electrons in the lens galaxy. There doesn't seem to be much evidence in the radio data for that effect. So I think the answer to this question is no, but that needs to be established rigorously.
Well, so we actually have a pretty strong evidence that the answer is no, even in the radio. I mean, just from the fact that the flux ratio is not dependent on frequency.
Yeah. Right. So if you have multi-frequency data in the radio, and even more, yes, thank you. If you can maybe resolve the shapes of the images, then you can get additional information. So I think the answer, again, I think the answer to this question is no, but we need to establish it as thoroughly as possible. And then once you can do that, you can compare to CDM, and there are a lot of interesting questions to ask about the predictions of CDM, and then ultimately comparing that to the physics of the dark matter. So these are, I think, a set of questions that I think are very exciting, both for the issue of trying to really understand what's going on with the substructure lensing, but also just a lot of intrinsically interesting questions about the predictions of CDM that I've been interested in talking to various people about. So I'll be around rest of the day, all day tomorrow. Be happy to talk to anybody any further about any of these other of these or other topics. So thank you, and I'll stop there. Rush.
Yeah, I just don't understand why is it useful to divide this into smooth and non-smooth areas? What you call smooth, somebody else might call non-smooth. And so, right? I mean, adding an optical or protocol would change maybe your conclusion. So,
right.
We have to move beyond just this simplified model and just see what maybe work with simulation directly. Forget about all this simplified models.
Absolutely. I think there's room to do. Certainly, it would be valuable to work with the simulations directly, and I've actually been talking to Andrei Kravtsov about at Chicago about some of that. I still think that there is value in looking at the simple models because, for example, you mentioned quadrupole, octupole, whatever higher multipole moments you might want to add. First of all, the elliptical mass distributions that have included actually do include all higher order moments. The only thing is that they're all characterized, they're all correlated. So you actually do get you introduce some funny behaviors as you go to high ellipticity, say, because you get very large higher-order moments. But more generally, I think it's useful to look at the simplified models to ask the question, for example, can quadrupole moments produce these effects? I think given the observed separations, the angular separations between the images, I think you'd have to go to sort of m equals 10 multipole moments before you produce a noticeable effect. So I think it would be worthwhile to do the simplified analysis to sort of identify what are the most germane features to look for. But ultimately, this question, what is substructure, really, it does come down to a semantic question. What we call substructure, somebody else might call, just some normal feature of elliptical galaxies. And in that case, it may be more relevant for comparing to CDM to actually use simulations directly. The limitation there, I guess, is what the how well the simulations can probe the scales that are relevant for this problem.
Is it even
possible? I think it's possible to get down to. I think Andre said that he's got some simulations where he can resolve clumps down to 10^7 solar masses. I think that was the number he quoted. Dark matter only, right? So first of all, it would be useful just to do dark matter-only simulations and see what happens in those.
Because the same satellites don't do much.
What do you mean?
Well, the claim is that satellites by themselves.
Right, but
satellites are not enough.
Right, but the question is, if you start to add gas, is there any gas feature like you know, you have a little disk and you've got a warp in the disk, or you've got anything else that
you can call this without stars?
Any kind of feature that would be associated with stars or the gas, other than dark matter, that might produce this effect as well. So one way to test, you know, is to work with the pure dark matter simulations, but then you would have to understand, you'd have to still show that there aren't any gas or star related effects that could produce this as well.
There are.
I should talk to you more about this. The question then becomes, certainly there are. There are going to be tidal streams, very likely. There are going to be, you know, just little density perturbations in the stellar distribution and so forth. The question becomes, statistically, how common are they, and are they abundant enough to produce the effects as observed?
There's also effects like gas cooling, changing the halo stripping rates, things like that, which means all the satellites. Feedback.
Right. Yes. So all of those things are going to be complicated to add into this analysis. But interesting questions of their own right. And the question is, how well can we do any of those things, and how well can we understand them, or at least put constraints on them?
Once we solve galaxy formation, we'll probably. Yeah. I just don't think the simulations are anywhere near that.
I guess.
But then it doesn't make sense to work on this project. Then we don't even know whether it's a problem or not. It's again.
I was under the impression, at least, that the things that are a problem for galaxy formation, you can at least make an argument that they're not going to be, that they may not be so important for the satellites. That may be a disputable statement, and I should talk to you, and I should talk to Andre, and I should talk to others about that, about whether, in order to solve all these problems, we're going to have to solve galaxy formation first anyway, or whether some of these will allow simplifications, some reasonable simplifications, so you can actually do some of these problems even before we figure out galaxy formation completely.
It would be very hard to establish that they're not going to be problems, because it's such a non-linear interacting system. They'd always be in the back of your mind with a worry that one of these effects that you thought didn't affect the substructure problem actually does in some complicated backdoor way.
Uh-huh.
Satellite excites a resonance, which excites a bar mode, who the hell knows?
Right.
Yeah, but if most of these 10^78 satellites did not cool because of the UV background high redshift, then they are presumably undisturbed by any of these effects that you mentioned.
Suppose the larger satellites that did get cooler now give you granularity and potential on larger scales, but still enough to give scattering. The small satellites that are now moving out of bumpy position.
Oh, so you're saying that the smaller satellites could scatter off the larger satellites and be just.
I don't know whether this is a big effect or not, but you can just start cataloging infinite numbers of possible effects.
Most of that should still be on the dark.
Tidal stripping is dominated by how efficiently the gas can be, causing adiabatic contraction. There's all kinds of feedback effects.
Different question.
Uh-huh.
The 70 galaxies come up sort of piece by your book, and got this enormous scatter
here.
Can you go from that, or maybe you answered it and I can catch it? Can you go to that to make it scatter in each model? Pretend to observe them. I mean, because when you predict H-naught, you always, as you said, you want to find your typical, galaxy, your typical profile, and I just wondered, intrinsic scatter in the types of galaxies, I just wondered, I don't know if anybody actually qualified how much the scatters it was in terms of intrinsic scatter in H-naught.
Actually, that's a very good question. I'll say two things. One is to just consider the scatter in H-naught. So that's something that Chris Kachanek looked at earlier this year, is to look at the scatter and H-naught values that you get from different lenses.
Yeah, and he fit them all to the same model, and that's pretty complicated.
Right, right. And so, but the interesting thing, part of his motivation was to figure that if there's a scattering galaxy properties that would lead to a scattering H-naught, then if you fit all the time delay lenses with a single model, then you would still expect to get some scattering H-naught. And what he found is that, lo and behold, you take your five time delay lenses that all appear to be pretty clean systems, you fit them with one family of models, and they all give the same value of H-naught. You can change the profile and move them all back and forth collectively, but you don't see any scatter. The scatter, or turning it around, the lack of scatter in H-naught suggests that there's not a huge scatter in the galaxy profiles. And that's one way to do it. But the other thing is that I've been working with Dave Russin at CFA to take the masses that you measure from the lens galaxies and try to look at, in an ensemble sense, you measure the mass within the Einstein radius, but that's a different fraction of the effective radius for different lenses. And if you kind of put them all on the same scale, assuming that they're homologous in some sense, then you can look at the profile and the scatter that way. Well, that's, we're still working on, we don't have results of that yet. And then finally, you asked whether I could to look at that from this set of models. And I think the answer is yes, in principle. In practice, I'd be a little bit worried about it because in this particular analysis, I neglected dark matter halos of the lens galaxies. The reason is that I was focusing just to ask the question, can the stellar densities suppress the core images? And at the small radii, it's probably this only stellar mass matters. But at the sort of two effective radii that are relevant for lensing, you'd have to add dark matter halos, and then you'd have to ask the question, how do you add the dark matter halos to the different galaxies, and how would your conclusions depend on yeah. So
the people do actually use the actual stellar light profiles. What do you call it? The fact it finds different stellar light profiles doesn't really matter. You can actually use the
ones. The NUCA team has dynamic information.
Yes, they do.
So you can measure the scatter type galaxies profiles directly from their data. And then assume that they were all constant in
right.
Deriving this Hubble constant and using all these different
I see.
Then.
Ah, that's interesting. Okay, so you say, you look at the scatter at, say, fixed velocity dispersion.
Because what you wanted to do is use lots of different lenses, one set to constrain the radial profile, one set to constrain something else, and assume that underlying it all was something. But we can go and measure that assumption.
Right, okay. Actually, that's a good point. To say, to look at the range of galaxy properties at a given velocity dispersion and to ask, is it reasonable to assume that they're all similar in ways that would be relevant for lensing? Yeah, that's a good point.
But they measure the actual
lens. And it's the profile of the light, which may or may not match the profile of the mass.
The local profile is not too bad, right? But it might be elliptical. People can look at these variations, for example, fitting to the surface profile, they find out that they're very massive, and they all are one quarter profile.
Right. So but then the question is, right? The question is, what is then the mass around the dark matter halo around those galaxies?
No, that you can all answer by looking at the 74 profile that you have.
Right. But
no.
The NUCA team has dynamical information for their 70 galaxies. Pardon?
You use just the light profile.
I also use the dynamics to convert the light into mass. So I actually didn't assume a mass-to-light ratio.
That's right, but that has to do with data. I mean, what do you assume for the isotropy profile?
Right. So I did what.
That's very uncertain.
Right. So I did what the NUCA team did and assume isotropic velocity dispersion. But
we know from some other measurements that maybe isotropic cannot be.
Right. So then there's the question of, well, for dynamical information, that's for the Hubble constant analysis and for the lensing analysis. That's what Leon Koopmans and Tomas Atreyu are trying to do, to measure the velocity dispersions and then see, okay, given that additional information, what then can you say about the mass profiles? And that looks to be very promising.
Maybe we should cut this off.
Thank you.